He had glanced up to see more taken out, but he had vanished already. The tall halberdiers closing rank behind him. The boat for the tower is waiting at the steps. It must feel like going home. The familiar room with the narrow window. The table empty of papers, the pricket candle, the drawn blind. The window rattles, it startles him, and he thinks, I shall bolt the shutter. He's rising to do it when Rafe comes in with a book in his hand. It is his prayer book that Moore had with him at the last. He examines it. Mercifully, no blood specks. He holds it up by the spine and lets the leaves fan out. I already did that, Rafe says. Moore has written his name in it. There are underlinings in the text. Remember not the sins of my youth. What a pity he remembered Richard Richards. Shall I have it sent to Dame Alice? No. She might think she's one of the sins. The woman has put up with enough. In his last letter, he didn't even say goodbye to her. He shuts the book. Send it to Meg. He probably meant it for her anyway. The whole house is rocking about him. Wind in the eaves, wind in the chimneys, a piercing draught under every door. It's cold enough for a fire, Rafe says. Shall I see to it? He shakes his head. Tell Richard tomorrow morning go to London Bridge and see the bridge master. Mistress Roper will come to him and beg her father's head to bury it. The man should take what Meg offers and see she is not impeded and keep his mouth shut. Once in Italy, when he was young, he had joined a burial party. It isn't something you volunteer for, you're just told. They had bound cloth across their mouths and shoveled their comrades into unhallowed ground, walked away with the smell of putrefaction on their boots. Which is worse, he thinks, to have your daughters dead before you, or to leave them to tidy away your remains? There's something... He frowns down at his papers. What have I forgotten, Rafe? Your supper? Later. Lord Lyle? I've dealt with Lord Lyle. Dealt with the River Humber. With the slanderous priest from Mary Woolchurch. Well, not dealt with him, but put him in the pending pile. He laughs. You know what I need? I need the memory machine. Guido has quit Paris, they say. He has scuttled back to Italy and left the device half-built. They say that before his flight, for some weeks he had neither spoken nor eaten. His well-wishers say he has gone mad, awed by the capacities of his own creature, fallen into the abyss of the divine. His ill-wishers maintain that demons crawled out of the crannies and crevices of the device, and panicked him so that he ran off by night in his shirt, with not even a crust and a lump of cheese for the journey, leaving all his books behind him and his Magus's robes. It is not impossible that Guido has left writings behind in France. For a fee they might be obtained. It is not impossible to have him follow to Italy. But would there be any point? It is likely, he thinks, that we shall never know what his invention really was. A printing press that can write its own books? A mind that thinks about itself? If I don't have it, at least the King of France doesn't either. He reaches for his pen. He yawns and puts it down and picks it up again. I shall be found dead at my desk, he thinks, like the poet Petrarch. The poet wrote many unsent letters. He wrote to Cicero, who died 1,200 years before he was born. He wrote to Homer, who possibly never even existed. But I have enough to do with Lord Lyle and the fish traps and the Emperor's galleons tossing on the Middle Sea. Between one dip of the pen, Petrarch writes, between one dip of the pen and the next, the time passes. And I hurry. I drive myself and I speed towards death. We are always dying. I while I write, you while you read, and others while they listen or block their ears, they are all dying. He picks up the next batch of letters. A man called Batcock wants a license to import 100 tons of woad. Harry Percy is sick again. The authorities in Yorkshire have rounded up their rioters, and divided them into those to be charged with the fray and manslaughter, and those to be indicted for murder and rape. Rape? Since when do food riots involve rape? But I forget. This is Yorkshire. Rafe, bring me the King's itinerary. I'll check that, and then I'm finished here. I think we might have some music before we go to bed. The court is riding west this summer, as far as Bristol. The King is ready to leave, despite the rain. They will depart from Windsor, then to Reading, Missenden, Abingdon, moving across Oxfordshire, their spirits lifting, we hope, with the distance from London. He says to Rafe, if the country heir goes to work, the Queen will return with a big belly. Rafe says, I wonder the King can stand the hope each time. It would wear out a lesser man. If we ourselves leave London on the 18th, we can aim to catch up with him at Hughley. Will that work? I'd better leave a day earlier. Consider the state of the roads. There won't be any shortcuts, will there? He will use no fords but bridges. And against his inclination, he will stick to the main roads. Better maps would help. Even in the Cardinal's day, he was asking himself, might this be a project we could undertake? There are maps of a kind. Castles stud their fields, their battlements prettily inked, their chases and parks marked by lines of bushy trees, with drawings of harts and bristling boar. It is no wonder Gregory mistook Northumbria for the Indies, for these maps are deficient in all practical respects. They do not, for example, tell you which way is north. It would be useful to know where the bridges are, and to have a note of the distance between them. It would be useful to know how far you are from the sea. But the trouble is, maps are always last year's. England is always remaking herself, her cliffs eroding, her sandbanks drifting, springs bubbling up in dead ground. They regroup themselves while we sleep, the landscapes through which we move, and even the histories that trail us. The faces of the dead fade into other faces as a spine of hills into the mist. When he was a small child, 6 years old or about that, his father's apprentice had been making nails from the scrap pile. Just common old flatheads, he'd said, for fastening coffin lids. The nail rods glowed in the fire, a lively orange. What for do we nail down the dead? The boy barely paused, tapping out each head with two neat strokes. It's so the horrible old buggers don't spring out and chase us. He knows different now. It's the living that turn and chase the dead. The long bones and skulls are tumbled from their shrouds, and words like stones thrust into their rattling mouths. We edit their writings. We rewrite their lives. Thomas More had spread the rumour that little Bilney, chained to the stake, had recanted as the fire was set. It wasn't enough for him to take Bilney's life away. He had to take his death, too. Today, Moore was escorted to the scaffold by Humphrey Monmouth, serving his turn as Sheriff of London. Monmouth is too good a man to rejoice in the reversal of fortune, but perhaps we can rejoice for him. Moore is at the block. He can see him now. He's wrapped in a rough grey cape that he remembers as belonging to his servant John Wood. He is speaking to the headsman, apparently making some quip to him, wiping the drizzle from his face and beard. He is shedding the cape, the hem of which is sodden with rainwater. He kneels at the block, his lips moving in his final prayer. Like all the other witnesses, he swirls his own cloak about him and kneels. At the sickening sound of the axe on flesh, he darts one glance upwards. The corpse seems to have leapt back from the stroke and folded itself like a stack of old clothes, inside which, he knows, its pulses are still beating. He makes the sign of the cross. The past moves heavily inside him, a shifting of ground. So, the King, he says, from Gloucester, he strikes out to Thornbury, Then Nicholas Poins's house at Iron Acton. Does Poins know what he's letting himself in for? From there to Bromham. Just this last year, a scholar, a foreigner, has written A Chronicle of Britain, which omits King Arthur on the ground that he never existed. A good ground, if he can sustain it. But Gregory says, no, he is wrong. Because if he is right, what will happen to Avalon? What will happen to the sword in the stone? He looks up. Rafe, are you happy? With Helen? Rafe blushes. Yes, sir. No man was ever happier. I knew your father would come round, once he had seen her. It is only thanks to you, sir. From Bromham, we are now in early September, towards Winchester. Then Bishop's Waltham, Alton, Alton to Farnham. He plots it out across country. The object is to get the king back to Windsor for early October. He has his sketch map across the page, England in a drizzle of ink, his calendar quickly jotted running down it. I seem to have 4-5 days in hand. Ah, well. Who says I never get a holiday? Before Bromham, he makes a dot in the margin and draws a long arrow across the page. Now here, before we go to Winchester, we have time to spare. And what I think is, Rafe, we shall visit the Seymours. He writes it down. Early September. 5 days. Wolf Hall. Author's note. In parts of medieval Europe, the official New Year began on the 25th of March, Lady Day, which was believed to be the date when an angel announced to Mary that she was carrying the child Jesus. As early as 1522, Venice adopted the 1st of January as the start of the new year, and other European countries followed at intervals, though England did not catch up till 1752. In this book, as in most histories, the years are dated from the 1st of January, which was celebrated as one of the 12 days of Christmas, and was the day on which gifts were exchanged. The gentleman usher, George Cavendish, after the death of Wolsey, retired to the country, and in 1554, when Mary came to the throne, began a book, Thomas Wolsey, Late Cardinal, His Life and Death. It has been published in many editions, and can be found online, in an edition with original spelling. It is not always accurate, but it is a very touching, immediate and readable account of Wolsey's career and Thomas Cromwell's part in it. Its influence on Shakespeare is clear. Cavendish took 4 years to complete his book, and died just as Elizabeth came to the throne.
You have been listening to Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel, narrated by Simon Slater.